Well, good morning. It's always a privilege to be back. And we are going to do something today that is very unusual. Usually what I do when I come here is I pick a passage out of the Bible and try to expound that. But this morning we're going to be doing something very different. And what we're going to be talking about is the legal and the social aspects of evolution. And this church has had many presentations on the whole subject of creation versus evolution. And I'm going to try to give you an angle on that whole topic that you may have never thought about before. My background is in law, and there are many people here that are lawyers and law students as well. And so what we're going to talk about is the impact of Darwinian evolution upon judicial philosophy and interpretation. How many of you know there's a war taking place over the soul of this country as we speak? It's been going on for several decades, actually, and even beyond that. And what I'm going to talk about this morning, I believe, is the number one culture war issue in terms of the fight over which direction the country's going to follow. Are we going to follow our Judeo-Christian heritage, or are we going to go into a new humanistic direction? And this has to do with how judges interpret our Constitution. And that's what I'm trying to flesh out this morning. When we deal with the subject of evolution, the first thing we have to understand is we're not dealing with a biological and scientific issue only. We are dealing with a worldview issue. Evolution is far more than just a scientific argument. It has to do with the area or the realm of worldview. Henry Morris, who many of you know, his son comes here to preach. But back in the 1980s, the late Henry Morris wrote a book called The Long War Against God. Has anybody read that book? Okay, now if I could assign a book, if I had the power to assign a book to you and make you read it, besides the Bible, this would be the book I would assign. Because in that book, what he shows is that evolution and evolutionary thinking is the seedbed of all of the various anti-God philosophies of our day, all of the isms, communism, Nazism, racism, atheism, secular humanism, New Age, all arise out of an evolutionary perspective. And this explains why evolution is so protected in our society. If evolution were to suddenly fall, all of these other isms would collapse as well. And this principle is true also in the field of the law, particularly in the field of constitutional interpretation. Here is a Yale political scientist, and he says, "The appearance in the mid-18th century of the concept of evolution was an event of transcending importance to the development of American jurisprudence. This involved a shift from the rationalistic, deductive pattern characteristic of the pre-Darwinian period to the empirical, evolutionary approach that is followed today." There's been a shift in philosophy regarding how judges or jurists approach our Constitution. Most of us are aware of that, but very few of us understand that this is all rooted in evolution. Evolution is behind much of it. And most of us look at our legal system today and we see strange things going on and we recognize something's out of kilter, but we really can't put our finger on exactly what the problem is. And what I'm going to try to share with you this morning is the problem, so we can put our finger on it. So many problems taking place all around us. You remember Roy Moore, Judge Roy Moore, wanted to post a copy of the Ten Commandments in his courthouse And all of a sudden a federal court appears and says, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. Another situation in Massachusetts arose where the Massachusetts Supreme Court said, all of a sudden out of almost thin air, there is a right for homosexuals to marry. Again, a judicial decision. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals one day wakes up and says, you know what? The Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. And most of us are sitting around and we're scratching our heads and we're saying, what in the world is happening? And what I'm going to share with you this morning is these things that we are seeing all around us in our judicial system are simply the ripened fruit of an evolutionary change which was introduced in the law schools in about the year 1870. And so that's the direction I'm moving in this morning. However, we won't grasp the magnitude of these changes that evolution has brought to the field of constitutional interpretation until we first have a historical perspective. In other words, we really don't understand how out of kilter things are today unless we understand the original vision of the founding fathers for our judicial branch of government. Most of this history has been forgotten. And so when we see strange things taking place today, we don't really understand how strange they are. Because as I'm going to share with you, they are completely out of whack in terms of the original vision that our founding fathers established. And so as we go back into history and we study our founding fathers, we realize that they had a very humble vision for the judicial branch of government. All our founding fathers ever expected was for our judges simply to follow the text of the Constitution. The function of a judge was to be a finder of the law. He was not to be a creator of the law. He was not to be a maker of the law. And I have several quotes to share with you. Here is Thomas Jefferson reflecting on what a judge should do. Now, Thomas Jefferson, I think, would know something about the foundation of America, wouldn't he? Thomas Jefferson says, what should a judge do? Carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit in the debates. Instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. Thomas Jefferson said, hey, you want to know what a judge should do? He simply goes back and discovers the intent of the author and applies it. Here is Chief Justice John Marshall, who was our third U.S. Supreme Court Justice. John Marshall said in a case in 1827, regarding judicial interpretation. He said, to say that the intention of the instrument must prevail, that this intention must be collected from its words, that its words are to be understood in the sense in which they are generally used by those for whom the instrument was intended, that its provisions are neither to be restricted into insignificance, nor extended to objects not comprehended in them, nor contemplated by its framers, is to repeat what has already been said, more at large, and is all that can be necessary. Now here's our third Supreme Court Justice just laying out in a case, 1827, what a judge should do. What should a judge do? A judge should not invent things in the text that aren't there. His job is simply to be a finder of the original intent of the authors and to apply it to whatever legal dispute comes before him. Here is a scholar. His name is G. Edward White. He's looking back on the Marshall era. And he says, the only power that judges had under Marshall's view was their professional power. Their technical expertise enabled them to be better finders of the law than other persons. So back in that day when you went to law school, basically what you did is you were trained in exegesis, which we do with the Bible. You were trained in discovering the intent of the author. And that's all your expertise enabled you to do. And you simply applied the original intent of the author to a situation that comes before you. Never in their wildest minds did the founders ever envision anything related to judges creating law or making up law. Here is Joseph Story, who wrote some very influential commentaries on the United States Constitution very early in our history. And he says, the reader, in the preface of his commentary, must not to expect to find in these pages any novel views and novel constructions of the Constitution. I have not the ambition to be the author of any new plan of interpreting the theory of the Constitution, or of enlarging or narrowing its powers by ingenious subtleties and learned doubts. Upon subjects of government, it has always appeared to me that metaphysical refinements are out of place. A constitution of government is addressed to the common sense of the people, and it was never designed for trials of logical skill or visionary speculation. Hey, discovering what a judge should do, Joseph Story says in this commentary on the Constitution, is not complicated at all. Find what the text says, what it means, and apply it. Now, what happens if the Constitution needs to be changed? You know, we're living in the 21st century, and that Constitution way back then is an 18th century document. Times have changed. Well, the Constitution itself tells you how the document is to be changed if it should ever need to be changed. And that would be something called Article 5, which is the amendment process. And the amendment process is a deliberately difficult process. You know, to get a constitutional amendment passed, 3/4 of the states have to sign on to it. And consequently, what happens, our founding fathers said, if you want to change the document, you have to go through the amendment process. But it's not an easy process, because the people that make the decision to change the document are not the judges, but the elected representatives of the people. George Washington put it this way: if in the opinion the distribution or modification of constitutional powers be at any particular wrong, let it be corrected by amendment, the way the Constitution itself designates, but let there be no change by usurpation. Though this may in one instance be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. And so what you see when you look at our Constitution and you read what the Founding Fathers said is they designed for our judicial branch of government a very humble role. In fact, David Barton, who's a historian, puts it this way. He says, as in many documents, the Constitution lists the most important aspects first, progressing to those of lesser consequence. Following the preamble, Article 1 describes the Congress, Article 2 the presidency, Article 3 the judiciary. Not only does the order of listing reveal their relative position of importance, but the amount of detail provided by each branch also reflects its relative importance. The legislature, Article 1, received 255 lines of print, while the presidency, Article 2, received only 114 lines of print. The judiciary, Article 3, merited only 44 lines of print. And what David Barton is saying is, if you look at the structure of the Constitution itself, and you notice that our system of government has three branches of government, you notice that the judiciary is listed last of the three. And furthermore, there is less space devoted to discussing the judiciary than there is to the Congress or to the presidency. You see, our founding fathers were far more fearful of the presidency, and they were far more fearful of the Congress than they were the judicial branch of government. They probably would never have appointed federal judges for life had they had been threatened by the judicial branch of government. They were far more concerned about abuse of power from the president and abuse of power from the Congress. And we have what are called the Federalist Papers. Chances are, if you're under 20 years of age, you may have never even heard of the Federalist Papers, because the Federalist Papers really aren't taught any longer in many school districts. The Federalist Papers were written by Hamilton, Madison and I believe John Jay, and they were written to convince the state of New York to ratify the Constitution. And these Federalist Papers were printed in the public newspapers, and they were to convince New Yorkers to go ahead and ratify the Constitution. And one of the things the New Yorkers were fearful of was the judiciary. And so consequently, we have Federalist Paper number 78, I think written by Hamilton. And Federalist Paper number 78 specifically says that the judicial branch of government is the least dangerous branch of government. The Federalist Papers are a tremendous source of light for us in terms of determining what our Founding Fathers intended. And in Federalist Paper number 78, the Founding Fathers simply said, don't worry about the judicial branch of government, it has no power anyway. John Jay, who was our first Supreme Court justice, refused a second nomination as Chief Justice because he had no faith that the court would ever acquire enough energy, weight, or dignity to play an integral role in the affairs of the nation. So the president wanted to reappoint him as Chief Justice to the Supreme Court, and John Jay said, you know what, I don't want that job because it's a dead-end job. It has no power. The court will never gain any real authority to do anything significant in our nation, so I think I'll go do something productive with my life. Our court, Supreme Court, most Americans don't know this, did not even have its own building. Until the year 1935, the Supreme Court met in the basement of the Senate and in small apartments and other places. In fact, it wasn't even until the Eisenhower administration that our Supreme Court even met on a full-time basis. And so what I'm laying out for you is the original vision that we find spelled out in the Constitution. What you see as you study our Founding Fathers is you see a very humble, powerless, almost impotent role for the United States Supreme Court. And this structure that I am describing for you began to take a radical shift in the year 1870. And you can't really understand what's happening today until you understand where we once were. And so that's why I'm laying this groundwork for you. Something happened in the year 1870. I want to give you three names of people, and everybody who studies this issue traces it to three individuals. And I want you to see where the shift started. The shift started in academic circles. The shift started with a change of philosophy. I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said, "The philosophy of the little red schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next generation." And in essence, that is what happened. It wasn't a politician that brought these changes about, even a judge that brought these changes about. This took place in academia. And here are the three names. The first is Columbus Langdell. The second is Roscoe Pound. And the third individual is named Oliver Wendell Holmes. Columbus Langdell was the dean of Harvard Law School, and one of his successors was Roscoe Pound. And a student that went through Harvard Law School was a guy named Oliver Wendell Holmes, who took the principles that he learned at Harvard, and he took them to a 30-year career on the United States Supreme Court. And what were Langdell and Pound, and then their student, Holmes, what did they begin to espouse? Well, they began to espouse a new approach to constitutional interpretation. The technical word for this is what we call legal positivism or positive law. And according to the legal positivist school of thought, the goal of a judge was no longer to study the Founding Fathers. It was no longer to study America's original documents. Rather, it was to study the needs, wants, and desires of a changing society. Watch this very carefully. And to reinterpret the Constitution so that it keeps up with a changing society. Now, I just described that in a few words, but that is a radical shift that happened. The legal positivists arose about the year 1870 and they said, you know, this approach that we've been doing in America is not the right way to go. Because after all, we have a changing society. And so the function of a judge is not to study America's original documents, but it is to study the upward trajectory of a changing society in terms of its needs, wants, and desires. And it's simply to reinterpret the document to keep up with society. Now you say, that's a strange change. What precipitated this change? Why this radical shift? And I mentioned that these changes happened, most people believe, about 1870. So here's a question I have for you. Somebody tell me what happened in 1859. Something was published in 1859. A book called Origin of the Species, which was not a legal book. It was a book primarily about science and the like, although there were some racial overtones in it. But it was primarily about science. And what had happened is Darwin's ideas, the origin of the species, had been in circulation for 11 years and had begun to be embraced. They had begun to be accepted. And one of the things you need to understand about Darwinism is it's not just an issue related to biology and science. It is a worldview issue. Darwinism brings with it an anthropology. What is anthropology? Anthropology is the study of man. Darwin brings with it a doctrine of man. And what is this doctrine of man that Darwinism brings? The doctrine goes like this. Man arose from the lower species. You know, from the goo to the zoo to you, as the saying goes. But the evolutionary process has not stopped. That's the point I'm trying to make. The evolutionary process continues. Just as man ascended upwardly from the lower species, man continues to ascend upward. Some would even say to a place of deity. Now, how does all of this affect judicial interpretation? Well, if man is evolving upward, then man can no longer be shackled to an 18th century document. The document has to evolve. The document has to change. The document has to ascend with man. And so the function of the judge then shifted in 1870 away from studying the original intent of the framers and applying it to legal disputes, away from that to guiding the evolution of society. The function of a judge now becomes to study where is society moving? Where is society headed? Where is the next quantum leap in evolution coming from? When is it going to occur? And the function of a judge is to keep reinterpreting the document so that it keeps up with an ever-changing, ever-evolving, upward-ascending human race and constitution. And so, as a result, the Constitution became known as a living and, what? Breathing document. We hear that phrase all of the time, but we don't understand its roots. What do they mean by a living and breathing document? I mean, that's an attractive idea, isn't it? I like a document that lives and breathes. I guess the opposite would be believing in a dead document. I don't want a dead document. I want a living and breathing document. See, it's very interesting how they have selected their wording very carefully. Simply by choosing that phrase, they have categorized everybody who wants to believe in the original intent of the founders as believing in something dead. Whereas they, by contrast, are believing in something that is alive. What do they mean by a living and breathing document? Basically, what they mean by that is the Constitution can have a meaning independent of the original authors. The Constitution is no longer a fixed set of principles because the Constitution has to evolve or change from one generation to the next. Well, who changes it? I showed you earlier the quote by George Washington. He says, if it wants to be changed, you've got to go through the amendment process, Article 5. The people's representatives have to have a say in how the document is changed. But under the positivist school of thought, the judge is the one that changes the Constitution. And so this introduced a tremendous shift in the role of a judge, away from studying the intent of the framers and towards guiding the evolutionary process of the law. And believe it or not, what I have just described for you in just the brief time we've had this morning is the most dominant philosophy that is taught in American law schools ever since. Now, you may be saying, well, Andy, you may be overstating your case a little bit. Are you sure we can really connect all this to evolution? Let me show you a few quotes. I'm going to show you a few quotes from some legal positivists. I just want to show you how many times the word evolution shows up in their thinking. This is Justice Brennan, and he gave a 1985 address to the American Bar Association, and he continued that this evolutionary process is inevitable. And in fact, it is the true interpretive genius of the text. And then we have Lawrence Tribe. Most people today really don't even know who Lawrence Tribe is. Lawrence Tribe is a professor at Harvard Law School. He's probably the number one legal positivist in the land. The number one espouser of this new philosophy, of this new doctrine. He's a very influential individual. Sometimes his words and what he says even show up in Supreme Court opinions. And Lawrence Tribe wrote a textbook on the Constitution, and he says in the preface, the Constitution is an intentionally incomplete, often deliberately indeterminate structure for the participatory evolution, there's our word, of political ideas and governmental practices. He says a few pages later, the highest mission of the Supreme Court, in my view, is not to conserve judicial credibility, but in the Constitution's own phrase, to form a more perfect union between right and rights within that charter's necessarily evolutionary design. What all of these positivists are saying is this. The Constitution was intended by the Founding Fathers to be ambiguous, because they knew society would change. And therefore, the function of the judge is to shape the language of the document one direction or the next, depending on where the evolutionary trajectory of society is headed. That's a far cry from an earlier quote I had here of Joseph Story. That is a far cry of an earlier quote I had here of Chief Justice John Marshall, who are all arguing that the function of a judge is not to create law, but to find it. You find it in the document itself. You find it in the intent of the author, and you apply it. But with the advent of legal positivism and William Brennan and Lawrence Tribe and shifts that began in the law school in the 1870, and with Roscoe Pound and Columbus Langdell and Oliver Wendell Holmes, there was a radical shift that took place. And it was preceded by Darwin's Origin of the Species, published 11 years before. And so, John Eidsmo, who's a very good scholar to study if you're interested in this subject, a conservative, he puts it this way. Underlying the disagreement over interpretation of the Constitution is a confrontation between two worldviews. That's what's happening. There's a confrontation taking place between two worldviews. We know there's a confrontation taking place because we see the heat that's generated from these political debates, but we don't see enough under the surface to see what's really happening. What we see is just fruit, ripened fruit, but there's something beneath it that's the root. And he is putting his finger on the root of the problem, which is what I'm trying to do with you this morning. He says, underlying the disagreement over interpretation of the Constitution is a confrontation between two worldviews. The creationist, absolutist, Newtonian views of the framers, who wrote that document long before Darwin even existed, versus the evolutionist, relativist, Darwinian views of most legal scholars today. So what I have tried to do so far is, number one, lay out the original vision of our founding fathers for the judicial branch of government. And number two, explain a radical shift that began in the year 1870 called legal positivism. Now, I know what some of you are saying. You're saying this is all academic and it doesn't affect our lives at all. In fact, what I'm moving into now is I want to explain to you what has happened to society as a result of this new methodology that I have been describing. I believe that this is the number one culture war issue taking place in our society today. And I want to describe for you four ways that this has had a tremendous impact on our society. It's not just an academic issue. It affects all of us. Number one, there has been a shift in authority in the area of constitutional interpretation from the text to the mind of the judge. Ed Meese, who was not a perfect man, but he was one of the few people in public life, I think, who had a grasp on this issue. He was our attorney general in the Reagan administration. Ed Meese summed it up this way. Under the old system, that's the Newtonian system that the framers developed, under the old system, the question was how to read the Constitution. Under the new approach, that would be the positive approach, under the new approach, the question was whether to read the Constitution. He's saying there's a shift in authority from the text to the mind of the jurist. Here are two quotes I want to give to you. One is by Felix Frankfurter of the traditional school, and the second one is by Charles Evans Hughes of the legal positivist evolutionary school of thought. Felix Frankfurter, the traditionalist, says, "The ultimate touchstone of constitutionality is the Constitution itself and not what we have said about it as judges." And then we compare that to Charles Evans Hughes, the positivist. He says, "We are under the Constitution, but the Constitution is what the judge says it is." In other words, my role as a judge gives me the right to read into the document whatever I see fit for the proper evolutionary progress of society. And consequently, how does this matter to us? Here's how it matters. As the legal positivist school has come into ascendancy, we are no longer governed by the Constitution. What we are governed by is the mind of the judge. Why is it that everybody is uptight and nervous in the month of June? Because in the month of June, the Supreme Court decisions generally begin to be passed down. And we're nervous because we don't really know what a judge will see in the document that wasn't there before, or what he won't see in the document that was there before. Because we have embraced a legal positivist paradigm, that a judge can read into the document what he sees to guide the evolutionary direction or progress of society. Prior to positivism coming, I bet you the month of June would have been the most boring month ever. But because of positivism, the month of June is nervous time. Another issue that's been put under stress has to do with inalienable rights. What are inalienable rights? Inalienable rights are rights that every American possesses because they are given to him or her by God. Now, is that the opinion of some raving right-wing fanatic? No, that's the opinion of the Declaration of Independence, which says we are all endowed by our what? Creator with certain inalienable rights. We have rights not because a government gave them to me. We have rights not because a judge gave them to me. We have rights because they are given directly by God. Yet, if the Constitution is in a state of flux, if the Constitution can change from one year to the next, from one decision to the next, then the whole concept of inalienable rights is put under stress. One day, I could have a right. The next decision comes out, and that right could disappear. Just ask 40 million unborn children. Prior to 1972, 1973, it was generally acknowledged that unborn children had a right to be born, suddenly with the stroke of a pen, the right disappears. And roughly 1.5 million, probably close to 40 million unborn children in this country have lost their lives because of this issue. Are you telling me this is just an academic issue? This affects all of us. And legal positivism does not sit well or is not good bedfellows with inalienable rights. Because inalienable rights is the idea that a right is fixed because it's God-given. It can't be taken away. Legal positivism is saying the exact opposite. Legal positivism is saying everything is in a state of flux. And judges now have this awesome power to read things into the document that weren't there. It's a living, breathing document. It changes. No longer a fixed set of principles. And so therefore, the more legal positivism has come to the forefront, the more inalienable rights have deteriorated. Here's what Oliver Wendell Holmes said. I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. Janet Reno, former Attorney General in the Clinton Justice Department. This is what she said in the 1995 in the wake of the Waco incident, you remember. She says, now watch this very carefully, you've got to watch the language. She says, you are part of a government that has given its people more freedom than any other government in the history of the world. This is the highest law enforcement agent in that time period making a statement like this. And the statement is wrong on its face. Because it's not the government that gives us rights. She's saying the government has given us rights. Completely wrong. We have rights because they're given to us by God. And therefore, the function of government is to recognize those rights and to protect those rights. The state doesn't give the rights. The state doesn't take the rights away. And these quotes show that as positivism has emerged, there has been more stress on this whole concept of inalienable rights. Let me show you another area where this has brought tremendous changes. And it has to do with the whole concept of legal education. Legal education today is completely different than the way legal education used to be conducted prior to the year 1870. In fact, what's happened in legal education today is the ideas of the founding fathers are deemed irrelevant and obstacles to progress. You cannot extol, you cannot exalt the ideas of the founding fathers in legal education. Why is that? Because they represent a previous, under-evolved era. That's the logic. Well, they had good things to say for their generation, but look how much more enlightened we are because of this upward trajectory. And so consequently, if you buy into the idea that man is in an upward ascent, you begin to frown upon or not see yourself bound by the ideas of the founding fathers. John Dewey, well-known evolutionist, says the belief in political fixity of the sanctity of some form of state consecrated by the efforts of our fathers and hallowed by tradition is one of the stumbling blocks in the way of orderly change. He's saying all this business about the founding fathers and talking about the founding fathers and talking about the Constitution, it's holding us back. It's not progress, it's a stumbling block because you are shackling us to a previous under-evolved, unevolved era. Wayne Grudem, who is an evangelical systematic theologian, he puts it this way. He says, if human beings are evolving for the better, then the wisdom of earlier generations is not likely to be as thought of as valuable as modern thought. And so as positivism has risen to ascendancy, as people have bought into the idea that we are on an upward trajectory, what's the point about going back and being patriotic and talking about the Federalist Papers? What's the point of reading the Constitution? What's the point of reading the Declaration of Independence? That's all a bygone era. That's all in the distant past. As a young law student, I had to learn this the hard way. I used to naively, in class, raise my hand and try to make arguments based on the text of the Constitution, based on the Federalist Papers, based on the wisdom of our founding fathers. And one day, this professor I have got tired of this, and she shouted back, and she said, "Mr. Woods, why do you keep trying to shackle this class to the 18th century?" And of course, as a very young law student, I didn't quite understand what she was saying. But now that I have been schooled in legal positivist thinking, her statement made perfect sense. Because the past is a previous, under-evolved era, and things have changed. And by the way, the function of the judge is not to study originalism and apply it to new situations, but rather it is to guide the upward ascent of society. We're going to have a lot more to say about this in the second hour. Shall we pray? Father, we are grateful just for a little bit of time to reflect upon a worldview issue, something that affects us, something that touches all of our lives, maybe something we may not have thought directly about. But we ask, Lord, that you would give us open hearts and open minds to think about these issues in these critical times so we can be equipped to be your people, the salt and light of the earth, in the hour in which we live. And we'll give you all the praise and the glory. In Jesus' name.